previously on Obscured. We heard about a high-profile decision that has since been cited in dozens of other cases from several states.
SJC 11956, Commonwealth v. Jimmy Warren.
But it turns out no one had ever spoken with the original defendant, Jimmy Warren, not even his lawyer. That intrigued me, so I went looking.
They'll just stop me and, like, frisk me, like, mad randomly, and then just drive off. Won't even ask questions. It was happening to everybody, so I felt like if it wasn't happening to me, then it's not normal.
This is Obscured, the podcast from Kuvenda Media about critical issues that don't get much attention because they're complex, overshadowed, and have been largely out of the public eye. I'm Emily Previty, co-creator and executive editor of Obscured. In this limited series, From Words to Weapons, we're focused on survivors of law enforcement trauma. On this episode, my colleague Stephanie Marudis and I turn to UCLA law professor Joanna Schwartz to talk about barriers to law enforcement accountability. Schwartz is the author of the 2023 book, Shielded: How Police Became Untouchable.
As Emily mentioned, our conversation will give you some broader context for Jimmy's case. So if you haven't had a chance to hear the previous episode with Jimmy, give that one a listen first. Joanna, thank you for joining us and welcome to Obscured.
Thanks so much for having me.
You are a leading expert on police misconduct litigation in the United States. And before you became a law professor, you worked as an attorney in New York City on cases dealing with police misconduct, prisoners' rights, and the First Amendment. And we're just curious as to what initially drew you into practicing this area of law and researching these areas.
Well, I went to law school thinking that I would be involved in the criminal justice system to some degree. Before going to law school, I'd worked at an alternative to prison program in the Bronx and was spending my day in and out of the Bronx courthouse. And things that I saw there really inspired me to go to law school. Once I was in law school, I began working in a clinic representing a few different women who had been raped by corrections officers at a federal prison in Connecticut. And that experience working with those women on those cases really inspired me to want to do civil rights work. And after graduating, I clerked for a couple of years for judges and then found the job at a small New York firm that did civil rights work called Emery, Chelly, Brinkerhoff, and Abbaty. And it was an amazing experience working on prisoners' rights cases, police misconduct cases, other kinds of civil rights cases. The work that I did raised a lot of questions for me about what the impact was of these cases, about the many barriers to getting relief in these cases. And when I came to UCLA and had the opportunity to spend some time doing research, I started investigating the kinds of questions that had come to me during my time in practice about the impact of these cases on the ground and the many barriers to relief in bringing these cases. And those questions led to the beginning, first articles that I wrote and then inspired more questions and flash forward 15 years. And I keep finding things to investigate and to ask about that really are drawn from my work more than 20 years ago in New York.
So you built on that experience, and as you practiced, you had a front seat view to the ins and outs of civil rights lawsuits and settlements and suing the police on behalf of clients, you know, an experience that falls outside of the purview of the general public. And, you know, an experience that seems, as you indicated, 15 years later, that seems to have led you to write your book, Shielded: How the Police Became Untouchable. And in your introduction, you write that you wrote Shielded to set the record straight. And we were curious about that. And if you could break that down for us, you know, what was the misleading narrative that you had been hearing that didn't quite add up to what you knew and saw firsthand with your own eyes?
Well, I think that if you look at a lot of the current debate around police accountability and civil rights litigation, a lot of the counter-arguments against reform are that it's too easy to sue the police, that frivolous lawsuits are overflowing in courthouses across the country, that attorneys are ambulance chasers who are getting rich off of these cases, and officers are being threatened with bankruptcy for split-second mistakes that they make in the course of their jobs, and that all of those pressures of these lawsuits are discouraging people from becoming officers, from vigorously enforcing the law, and to create any more oversight or accountability would really threaten to lose policing altogether and to enter into a state of chaos where there was no one enforcing the law. And arguments along those lines have been made for about 150 years on and off, ever since first was created the right to sue for constitutional violations after the Civil War. And those arguments, those fears are very powerful, but I argue in Shielded that they are overblown and sometimes downright false. But they've been used by the Supreme Court, by state and local governments across the country, to create multiple barriers at every stage of the litigation process, what I'm referring to as shields. And qualified immunity is one protection that's been very much in the news recently, but part of my goal in writing this book is making clear that there are multiple shields, many that even those who think about these issues have rarely heard about. And my goal in this book is to set that record straight about the many barriers, about the myths that have justified those barriers, and why those myths really bear minimal relationship to how civil rights litigation works in practice.
When you write about, in your book, there should be meaningful accountability for law enforcement officers and officials and justice for their victims, you know, we would like to talk about that in context of our series, From Words to Weapons, which focuses on survivors of law enforcement trauma and how these shields create disparities of being able to access justice that victims often do seek.
Absolutely. These are shields that are in practice preventing people who have suffered sometimes often the most painful experience of their lives for themselves, for their loved ones, and the experience of whatever the harm is, the force, the assault, the violence, is its own trauma, of course. Then the experience of trying to get some manner of recognition or justice for that harm is where these shields that I'm describing come into play. And they can create, and often do create, their own secondary trauma of having to fight so hard against extraordinary odds to get some manner of justice. I know that you all are talking about a number of different cases in the course of this podcast, but there are multiple cases also in the book, people who have gone through those very same harms and trying to get justice through a system that really looks askance at victims in these cases is its own form of harm.
As we talk about these barriers to law enforcement accountability, one of the most significant and what you consider to be the most known is qualified immunity, as you've mentioned so far. Can you tell us about that? You know, what it means exactly and how it's been applied historically by the courts?
Qualified immunity is a protection for individual officers and other government officials who are being sued for money damages. And the Supreme Court created qualified immunity in 1967. It described it at the time as a good faith defense. So if an officer violated the Constitution but thought that they were acting in accordance with the law, then there was this good faith protection, according to the court. That's how it started in 1967. But over the decades, qualified immunity has gotten stronger and stronger and stronger, made stronger by the Supreme Court, fueled by myths about the dangers of making it too easy to sue. And The first shift that the court made in 1982 was to say, we don't care about whether the officer was acting in good faith anymore. The question should be an objective one, whether the officer violated what the court called clearly established law. And they made that shift so that it would be easier to dismiss cases on qualified immunity grounds earlier, so that officers wouldn't have to go through discovery and trial before they got qualified immunity's protections. Then the court interpreted what it meant to be clearly established law more and more narrowly. Really, where we are today, an officer has not violated clearly established law or is protected by qualified immunity unless there is a prior court decision from that very court holding unconstitutional almost precisely the same conduct. And so you see in the news often cases where an officer seems obviously to have violated the law, but because there is not a prior court case with nearly identical facts, they are shielded from liability by qualified immunity.
You mentioned before that qualified immunity has been in the news a lot. It's a major shield, if you will. But to talk about some of the other shields, you noted that there are major obstacles to even getting a plausible complaint together, which I don't think most people realize because of evidence that might be lacking prior to discovery. At least that's my understanding, and you can correct that if it's incorrect. But we were wondering if public access laws come into play at all. We know that states vary in their public access laws. Then again, it's also pretty universal to encounter agencies denying records requests because they're part of an active investigation. Does that hold water at all? Have you noticed or heard about states where it seems more or less difficult to put together a viable complaint due to more or less access to records?
You're absolutely right in your description of the challenges of filing a complaint in these cases, a complaint that sets out the basis for the claim. And the challenge is that the Supreme Court has said there needs to be what the court calls a plausible claim for relief, which can be particularly difficult when someone has, for example, died in police custody and family members don't know exactly what happened or who the bad actors were within the department. I talk in the book about a woman named Vicky Timpa, who learned that her son Tony had been killed in police custody by Dallas police officers. And there was video, body camera video, that the department had, but they have a state law that allows the police department to refuse to turn over any evidence while there is an investigation underway. And so she was unable to get this information. She went to the department repeatedly asking about what had happened to her son, and members of the department told her lies about what had happened to him and refused to turn this information over. And then when she tried to file her lawsuit, naming officers as John Doe's because she didn't know their identities, the city of Dallas tried to dismiss the case because it wasn't plausible, even though the city of Dallas knew very well who was involved in the case and had, in fact, body camera video that captured Tony's last moments. There is variation across states about their record-keeping laws and obligations, and it is undoubtedly easier to get this evidence and plead a plausible complaint in states and jurisdictions that have easier access to this information. But it's also true that this pleading standard makes things difficult everywhere because, to take Tony Timpa's case for a moment, this was a situation where there was body camera video. It was maintained. But what if there hadn't been body camera video? Or what if there had been body camera video that had then been deleted? This can be an issue, certainly, in cases whether or not they have decent laws on the books allowing for disclosure of this kind of information. So better public information access certainly makes things easier, but I don't think it solves the problems that we have with the Supreme Court's pleading standards.
What about when it comes to police accountability, public access, and it's tied to citizen oversight and things like that?
Absolutely. There are around the country different kinds of oversight bodies, and there's a wide range of different kinds of forms that these bodies take and variation in the kind of access that they're given, whether they have subpoena power, what kinds of recommendations they can make, and what power those recommendations have. And so it's difficult to generalize about the merits of these kinds of oversight bodies. To my view, some form of external oversight is better than nothing. And I think that the evidence is very clear that police departments typically don't do a very good job of investigating their own. But how much power these external oversight bodies, civilian review boards, auditors, and other types of bodies have depends upon what that jurisdiction is willing to give them. And that varies very much from jurisdiction to jurisdiction.
So you wrote in the book that it's not typical for people who believe they were mistreated by the police to file lawsuits, often because they don't believe they have the money to pay for an attorney. But one episode in our series focuses on a nurse researcher developing a protocol for caring for patients who present after a police encounter. And it's very early stage, but the vision is for a multidisciplinary approach along the lines of what's in place for survivors of other forms of trauma, such as sexual assault. And it would include calling in advocates who support could include legal expertise, referrals to an attorney, referrals to other aftercare. Have you heard about that being discussed or broached previously or anything that's similar in structure? And does that seem like something that could work?
I have not heard of this approach. It seems from your description like it certainly could work. My questions about it concern what the legal angle is, what degree of education is being offered, to the extent to which this is an offer of representation as opposed to education, because once a lawyer takes on a attorney-client relationship, there's a whole set of obligations that come into play. I also wonder what the financial structure is for the lawyers involved. Part of my description of the challenges of finding a lawyer is the challenges of lawyers getting paid in these cases. And that has to do with the ways in which the Supreme Court has interpreted the availability of fees for lawyers doing this kind of work. So I think that it makes sense as an approach, but I have some questions about the details.
In the book, you mentioned that in your research, you found that defendants raised qualified immunity in more than 37% in almost 1,200 cases that you reviewed. We were wondering, how significant is that rate? And was that a number you were expecting?
I actually thought that qualified immunity might have been raised more often in cases. Understanding how powerful qualified immunity is as a shield, how high the standard is to get past qualified immunity, that you have to find essentially a prior court case with virtually identical facts, I would have assumed that qualified immunity would always have been raised in 90% of cases. And the fact that it was filed less often than that, I don't think is proof that it's not a powerful shield. It is, in fact. But instead, that there are many, many other shields that make it difficult to succeed in these cases. We've just talked about the pleading standards. Pleading standards are one of those shields and come into play really before qualified immunity would become an issue. Finding a lawyer is a challenge that comes up from the very beginning. And if someone can't find a lawyer, they're going to have a hard time pleading a complaint that will get past the first line of defense, which is the pleading standard.
In the book, we read about this flurry of state legislative activity following George Floyd's murder in May of 2020. We know, unfortunately, that few of those bills were enacted. Since the book's been finished, I know it hasn't been that long, but I have to imagine that you're maybe among the first to know or hearing a lot more earlier on about jurisdictions maybe reviving some of those efforts or complementary reform.
So there has been legislation passed in Colorado in June of 2020, in New Mexico in 2021, and in New York City as well. In the remaining states, there have been many legislative efforts and bills introduced. Some were defeated and others were withdrawn or pulled for the moment and may very well be coming back. So there have been legislative hearings in a number of different states about these bills. And I feel confident that there will be more legislative action in the future. I can't predict precisely where the next state will be or when, but I do think that there's going to be continued action in this area. And part of the process, I think, of getting these bills enacted in other states is looking at the evidence of what's happening in New Mexico and in Colorado and New York City and measuring the effects of these state legislative efforts that have allowed people to sue for violations of the state constitution without qualified immunity as a defense. In opposition to these kinds of bills, there have been arguments that sound just like the arguments that have been made for the past 150 years, that if we create a right to sue without qualified immunity, that courthouses will be filled to overflowing with frivolous suits and officers will be bankrupted and won't want to do their jobs. And I'm actually in the process right now with two friends and co-authors of looking at what's happening in New Mexico and Colorado, looking at the number of cases that are being filed, looking at the settlements and judgments that are being rendered in those jurisdictions following the enactment of these statutes. And, you know, I'm still very much in the process of gathering that information and analyzing it. But I think it's fair to say that there are no reports of the sky falling in either of those states or courthouses being flooded or officers being bankrupted.
That's great that you guys are already on top of it with the structure in place. And
we're working on it. I mean, it's not easy to get this information, and we are sending public records requests to hundreds of agencies in New Mexico and Colorado trying to find out what's happening. But it's important and interesting as well to see what's percolating in those two states.
It sounds like you certainly have your hands full with that. And this is related. You know, you wrote about the prospect of tying accountability, excessive force lawsuit payouts to local law enforcement agency budgets, so not the individual police. And I mean, not that it's tied to it now, but almost as a counter to that, as like an alternative. So have any cities or counties formally proposed or enacted that, as far as you know? Have any local officials contacted you for guidance or perspective after maybe reading your book?
I have not been contacted by local government officials about my budgeting proposals, but I welcome them to about those proposals or anything else. Just as the background, in most cities and counties across the country, when there is a settlement or judgment entered against an officer, the officer does not pay. In my research of 81 jurisdictions across the country, I found that 99.98% of the dollars are paid by local governments or their insurers, not by the officers themselves, and that the police department's budget is similarly unaffected. I found that there's a variety of different ways that jurisdictions budget for and pay these settlements and judgments, but that a payout very rarely affects the police department's bottom line. They're not, for example, cutting down on overtime or equipment in order to satisfy a settlement or judgment. There are some jurisdictions, some state agencies, and some county agencies where the money does come out of the law enforcement agency's budget, and they are financially responsible for those settlements and judgments. The Los Angeles Sheriff's Department is one of those jurisdictions. And what was reported to me was that having that budgetary arrangement made the risk management arm think more carefully about these cases than if the money was coming from central funds. There's a lot of problems with the Los Angeles Sheriff's Department, in my view, and accountability problems. So I don't think that taking the money from these settlements and judgments out of a law enforcement agency's budget is a cure-all by any means. But I do think that it is a better arrangement to make an agency financially accountable for misconduct or harms caused by their officers than it is to have that money come from a central location in the budget with no feedback and no consequence for that agency. So it does happen in some places. I think that it should happen in more. And more generally, I think that departments should pay closer attention to the information in these suits, who was named in the lawsuit, what the information was that came out during discovery, what was paid, what the result was of the case. Often that information does not make it into the police department's own assessment of their policies and practices. And my intuition is that if they had to pay settlements and judgments in these cases, they might pay closer attention to the information in these suits.
On Obscured, we're covering issues that intersect with politics, government, and accountability. And we wanted to let you know about another show that's diving into big ideas about civic life and democracy. It's called Future Hindsight and is hosted by Mila Atmos. This award-winning podcast features conversations with changemakers and civic innovators and ideas for how citizens like you can take action to change the status quo and stay engaged. Find new episodes of the show every Thursday at futurehindsight.com or wherever you listen to podcasts. Now, let's get back to Obscured.
Just to go back to states briefly, when we're talking about the flurry of legislation, and sometimes laws generally can be poorly constructed. An example, this is a focus of another episode in our series, but we look at exoneration compensation. So an example there is people can be disqualified from going through those programs that are intended to give them some financial compensation without having to go through litigation. And in just a few states, if you've pleaded guilty or confessed, even if it's since been shown that you were coerced or manipulated to do so, you cannot go through the state's program intended to compensate people without going through litigation. So that's just an example of, you know, it's not the best structure. So were there any examples of some problematic components with some of the police accountability legislation that might not have been passed yet that you happen to notice?
I think that there's a lot of different levers that can be addressed and improved with this state legislation. And I don't think that I've seen many red flags of the kind that you're describing. And in part, that's because there's been so little legislation that's actually been enacted. But I do think that there are a lot of interesting questions that states will want to consider as they're deciding whether and how to enact this kind of legislation. In New Mexico, for example, the legislation that they enacted really turns these claims from claims against officers to claims against the jurisdiction. So that is something that is happening in New Mexico, but is not in Colorado. In New Mexico, all public employees fall under the statute. In Colorado, it's limited to law enforcement. In Colorado, there is a provision that I quite like that provides that when an officer has been found to have acted in bad faith, they can be required to contribute up to $25,000 or 5% of a settlement or judgment. And in my view, that is a valuable tool because it does create some financial responsibility in cases where officers have been found to act in bad faith while still making sure that people who've been harmed are going to be properly compensated. But that's not a provision that has been adopted anywhere else. I think it should, but it hasn't. So I don't see any red flags with the legislation that's been passed, but I do think that there are a lot of questions that states deciding whether to pass legislation and how to pass legislation should grapple with.
As you question in your book, what would happen if qualified immunity didn't exist? And we were curious to hear what that might actually look like, what would have to happen judicially, politically, for that even to be possible.
I think if we end qualified immunity, courthouses won't overflow with frivolous cases because lawyers have a lot of other reasons not to accept frivolous cases. Officers won't be bankrupted because there are across the country in states and counties and local jurisdictions, agreements that are called indemnification agreements or indemnification policies or laws that provide that when an officer is sued, they will be given a lawyer and any settlement or judgment will be paid by the local government. And those are agreements that are not tied to qualified immunity and would exist even if qualified immunity went away. Qualified immunity also isn't necessary to protect officers from making split-second mistakes on the job because the Constitution, as interpreted by the Supreme Court, already protects officers who have made reasonable mistakes. And so I don't think that any of the sort of sky is falling claims about ending qualified immunity will happen. I also don't think ending qualified immunity is going to usher in a golden age of police accountability. There are a lot of other barriers to relief in these cases, a lot of other reasons why people who have suffered grievous wrongs may not get their day in court or may get their day in court and ultimately be found not to have suffered a violation that a jury wants to compensate for. But I do think that getting rid of qualified immunity would do some very important things. It would make these cases less complicated, less risky, and less time-consuming to bring, which would mean, I think, that more lawyers would be willing to accept these cases, not to accept frivolous cases, but to not have dangers of qualified immunity discourage them from taking cases that are meritorious and strong. I also think that the focus of these cases should be on whether people's constitutional rights were violated, not on the happenstance of whether there was a prior court case with nearly identical facts. And so eliminating qualified immunity would get us as a nation, perhaps, but certainly as fact finders in civil cases, thinking more about that question, whether the Constitution was violated. I think that getting rid of qualified immunity would clarify the law. One of many things about qualified immunity that I think there are to dislike is the fact that the Supreme Court has said that an officer is entitled to qualified immunity if there's no prior court case with nearly identical facts. But the Supreme Court's also told lower courts that they can grant qualified immunity without ruling on whether the officer violated the Constitution, which ends up meaning that it can be very difficult to clarify the law, what the law means, what the law allows. And without qualified immunity, I think there would be more clarity about the law. That in and of itself is a good thing. And finally, one last benefit to ending qualified immunity is that it would end the slow but steady trickle of decisions from the Supreme Court and lower courts around the country where egregious police misconduct is held to be protected by qualified immunity. Justice Sotomayor in one decision said that qualified immunity sends the message to police that they can shoot first and think later. And I don't think that ending qualified immunity will end all police misconduct, but I do think it will send the message to police, or at least stop sending the message to police, that they can act with impunity.
What we're hearing from you is an extensive overhaul, really would be a game changer on a lot of different levels. And like you said, was the political will there to begin with. But you've really thought about it, you know, sort of the ins and outs of what that could look like. And are there other people around the country who are imagining this with you, who are trying to get that out there?
Absolutely. This is a topic about which the NAACP Legal Defense Fund and the ACLU and Cato and the Institute for Justice all agree. And judges appointed by Donald Trump and Barack Obama and every president of every political persuasion currently on the bench. So it is a really interesting topic. It really is an interesting place where people do seem to agree, even as there is so much about policing and police reform that people can't seem to agree about.
Are there any final thoughts that you would want to leave with listeners as they think about the various shields that we've talked about and heard from you about today?
I really appreciate the time that you're taking to get at these issues. Obscured is the right title for this podcast and for this conversation, because a lot of these areas of the law are obscured, are difficult to understand, difficult to understand how they operate together, and are more complex than quick or, or protest signs can reflect. But I do think it's extremely important to understand what these barriers are. And I also think for those who are compelled by the conversation, there's a lot that can be done at the state and local level to make these systems improve. And there are things that are happening across the country, not just about qualified immunity, but a variety of other efforts to increase accountability, reduce police violence that are happening at the local level. And so I really encourage listeners who are moved by this to get involved and to see what they can do at the local level.
Well, thank you so much for taking the time and for the kind words about our work and the podcast.
Of course, it's my pleasure.
Special thanks to Joanna Schwartz. If you haven't read Shielded, we highly recommend you pick up a copy. We covered a lot of ground in this episode, but there's definitely more to learn in the book.
Next time on Obscured, Emily brings us a reported episode about an exoneree named Chester Holman III. Chester spent nearly 3 decades incarcerated for a murder he didn't commit, and was the subject of a Netflix documentary and media coverage after his 2019 release from prison. Emily will detail his challenges managing his mental health and advocacy work amidst the backdrop of the Pennsylvania state legislature attempting to oust progressive district attorney Larry Krasner. As you'll hear from Emily, Chester's story and the current circumstances surrounding the criminal justice landscape in Philadelphia illustrate some of the obstacles to helping and supporting people like Chester.
Police officers, I thought they were just so, like they were heroes, supermen, I just believed that because that's what I was taught. And along this journey that I've been on for these 30 years, I've just seen that that's not necessarily the case.
In the meantime, for more about Obscured and the rest of our work, keep up with us on social at Kuvenda Media. Obscured's From Words to Weapons series is produced by Kuvenda Media and mixed by Brad Linder. Our series was edited by Diane Hodson and fact-checked by Chelsea Zhu. Malik Calhoun composed the music for this episode and the rest of our series.
Special thanks to Obscured's fiscal sponsor, Media Alliance, which is one of the oldest media change organizations in the United States and helps our podcast receive tax-deductible contributions. And we're grateful to Obscured's founding supporters who've made donations to support our journalism initiative.
You can help more people discover Obscured by leaving us a review on your favorite podcast app and sharing it with others who might be interested.
I'm Stephanie Marudis, Kuvenda Media's executive producer and Obscured's co-creator.
And I'm Emily Previty, executive editor and co-creator of Obscured. Thanks for listening.